We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
This is Darius Miller.
This is Drew Hardy.
This is Lance Thomas, Tyree Gavin.
Jason Smith.
Anthony Davis of the New Orleans Pelicans.
You're listening to.
And you are listening to In the Know.
In the Know.
The Bourbon Street Shots.
Bourbon Street Shots podcast.
All Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. With a whole bunch of new additions to the team, including Jimmer Fredette and previously Tyreek Evans and Omri Caspi, we thought that since we are now becoming the New Orleans Kings, we decided to bring on James Hamm of Cowbell Kingdom to talk about all the brand new Sacramento players we're adding to this team. James, thanks for coming on.
You forgot John Salmons. How dare you?
I'm really trying hard to forget John Salmons. I'll be honest.
So are Kings fans.
Yeah. So at least I could say we're only paying him a couple million a year.
Yeah, you didn't sign him to a 5-year, $25 million deal like Jeff Petrie did?
He scored 18 points a game that one season.
Yeah, and you know what? The Kings won, I think, 38 games, right? Yeah, I think the Kings were actually competitive that year, the first year they signed him, and he had a good start. Yeah, you do have a lot of Kings players. It's very intriguing to see.
Right. So I think who we should start with, though, and I think Michael, of course, living in Utah, wants to start with him, too. Our good buddy, Jimmer Fredette. My Twitter feed blew up. It was Jimmer time now in New Orleans as soon as they signed him. So, first off, does he have that much of a fan base, really? Is he going to be, like, are we going to have lots of people asking Jimmer questions? Should we have, like, a Jimmer corner in our podcast now?
Yes. We call them Jimmer jockeys, and they're good people. But they're very passionate, and it was always our fault that Jimmer didn't play, which was always sort of a strange dynamic. It's like, look, we're not coaches. We're guys who cover the team, but it was always our fault. It was our fault if we didn't ask about Jimmer, why he wasn't playing. So they're very, very passionate, and they're very good for page views, but you do have to deal with some craziness and an occasional wild outburst filled with pseudo curse words, if you will.
Wow. So go ahead, Michael.
So, I mean, take me beyond what I could find on Basketball Reference, because, you know, if I'm just coming in raw, it looks a little weird to me. I see a team spend a 10th overall pick on a guy, you know, he doesn't have a horrible rookie season. Remember, we cover a team that had Austin Rivers' rookie season. So from our point of view, it looks like he doesn't have a horrible rookie season. His PER is about average his second year. Goes up even a little bit before you trade him in the third year. It looks like I see a guy with some potential, at least on paper, still a young guy. What am I missing that caused Sacramento to give up on him so soon, or for him not to even get heavy minutes in the first place?
Okay, well, Jimmer was really put in a bad situation, because what you have to look at him is he is a true combo guard, and while he would like to tell you he's a point guard, or some people like to tell you that he's just an undersized two, fact is he's a combo guard, and when the Kings drafted him, it was with the idea that they were going to put him next to Tyreke Evans, which is what you guys are going to attempt to do in New Orleans, for at least some portion of the game. And what he can do is he can open up an offense because he has unlimited range. He does have ball handling skills. He's a very, very good passer. He doesn't do well when people run traps at him or when there's a double team, but he does have ball handling skills. He's got very quick handles. And basically the idea was Doug Christie in Tyreke Evans and Mike Bibby in Jimmer Fredette. And because of the lockout, Jimmer didn't get a summer league like everyone else has, and then on top of that, 7 games into that first season, the Sacramento Kings in their infinite wisdom decided to part ways with Paul Westphal. So not only did he have no training camp, an abbreviated training camp, no summer league, but his first head coach was fired 7 games into the season after getting in a fight with DeMarcus Cousins, and sort of the rest becomes history, because what happens is Isaiah Thomas, who is a natural point guard, he's not a pass-first point guard, but it's the only position he can play. He steps right in and actually has a position he can play and steals the starting job away after just a little while. They move Tyreke Evans over to the 2. They even put him at the 3 at some point in that season. And they try to work this 3-guard set with Marcus Thornton, Isaiah Thomas. And Jimmer just kind of gets left out in the cold. Jimmer doesn't have great lateral quickness. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to argue that point. He's not a great defensive player. More than, I think, lateral quickness, Jimmer doesn't in particular like contact, and so that becomes a major issue. He's not a great rebounder because of that. He doesn't box out because of that. And so it just went south really, really quick. And, Keith Smart takes over. Keith Smart's there for a year and a half, and then Michael Malone takes over. Michael Malone is strictly a defensive guy. He has no use for a guy who can't, do specific skills for him. And they also had Marcus Thornton, who he'd had a history with. And they parted ways with him quickly. They didn't trade Jimmer Fredette. They waived Jimmer Fredette. They bought him out and let him go on his way.
Yeah. Well, the way I like to look at Jimmer right now is he's got a better true shooting percentage and turnover rate than Tyreke Evans, and he's got a better assist and usage rate than Eric Gordon and better rebound rate. So combined, he's going to be like all three of them, like all put together and be the best guard we have, right?
Hey.
What will he actually bring to this team? Is he just a shooter?
No, actually, he's got a beautiful floater in the lane. He's got all kinds of moves. I mean, he scored 27 points a game in college. I mean, he's an incredible scorer. The problem is that he's a ball-dominant scorer, and you guys have a lot of ball-dominant players. I mean, you got Drew Holiday, you've got Tyreke Evans, you got Eric Gordon. I mean, you already have guys who can only play with the ball in his hand. And that's sort of the issue that you have with Jimmer, is he's not a Steve Kerr catch-and-shoot. He's worked on that, and he's gotten better at that. But realistically, what I love about Jimmer is you guys will see this. It's a really strange phenomenon. Number one, he sells tickets. And it doesn't matter what part of the country you're in, there's a huge Mormon population. He is he's bigger than Mitt Romney with the Mormon people. They absolutely love him. And he has an ability to catch fire. And when he catches fire, you'll hear the murmur in the crowd start, and then it will start building. It's really, really strange to listen to because there are so many Jimmer fans that they just explode. And then as he starts building confidence and starts hitting shots, the arena gets louder and louder. At least it does in Sacramento. I know you guys do have trouble drawing fans on occasion, but for the Kings, you know, there, even if it's 12,000 people, the arena can still get really loud. And Jimmer has an ability to really excite people and really change the momentum of a game just because of the fans. He can get people involved so much quicker than the average player.
No, I mean, I understand that he does have a lot of other skills other than catch and shoot. It's, you know, just one thing in his bag of tricks that he could do. But if you look at his numbers, I mean, the catch and shoot, especially this past year, was by far the most efficient part of his game. Is there any way that he could hold out hope that maybe these first 3 years have humbled him, and instead of thinking of himself as more of a Steph Curry, maybe he can transition to a Steve Kerr role that, you know, a guy that could occasionally pull other things out, but just humbles himself and plays that Steve Kerr role? Or is he a guy that is always going to think he's more than that and therefore never be able to just settle for that role?
Okay, so here's the interesting dynamic about Jimmer Fredette. When he was at college at BYU, you saw Jimmer time. You've seen the You Got Jimmered shirts. There's this whole, like, a legacy of Jimmer, this built-up, like, thing. And the problem is it's not him. None of that is him. That is the fan base. That is the crazy Jimmer fans that go nuts. And they've created this legend, the legend of Jimmer Fredette. Jimmer in person is completely different. He doesn't want any of that. He wants to fit in. He wants to be one of the guys. He never once, like, you know, looked at someone and said, "You got Jimmered." You know, that's not him. And so when you say accept something, he's just looking for a coach that wants him. That's all. A coach that wants him for his incredible shooting ability and whatever he can bring to the court. They're going to ask him to do specific things. He can do more than that. Sometimes you want less of what he can do. But he's not one of those guys. He's not, I don't know, you know, again, the Kings in Summer League have Marshawn Brooks. He's not Marshawn Brooks. He's not a stone cold assassin that has ice in his veins, and every time he touches a ball, he's going to throw it up. He's not Swaggy P. He's not, you know, Jamal Crawford. That's not who he is. He is a very reserved, very respectful young guy, and I actually feel like that's part of the reason why he hasn't fit in the NBA game, because he's too nice. And I think he knows that, and you hope that, you know, he can stick around long enough for someone to give him an honest shot. But if you're going to get him 8 shots a game, he's going to score. He's going to score like crazy. He's going to hit 2 or 3 threes. He's going to hit a floater for you, maybe 2 floaters. If you get him 8 shots a game, he's going to average over 10 points a game. I guarantee it.
For a moment there, I felt like I needed to, like, bring in the crew of the TV show Community, because when you said he just needs a coach that wants him, I needed to have, like, Andy there saying, "Aw."
He does, though. No, I mean, there are some players that in the league that just don't fit in. And unfortunately, He doesn't fit in because he's a bad dude who's, like, you know, breaking chalkboards. He doesn't fit in because he's different, because he's married, because he's not out doing horrible things, you know, while he's in his hotel room. You know, that's who he is. He's a very quiet, reserved guy, and that's how he lives his life.
Yeah, I just find it curious that, you know, Malone kind of apparently gave up on him. Thibodeau really didn't play him any minutes. I would say the two best friends of Monty Williams as far as head coaching circles, you know, obviously he's closer with Nate McMillan, but he's not a head coach. I would say the two guys Monty's closest with as head coaches are Thibodeau and Malone. So, you know, I gotta, first of all, gotta wonder why Jimmer went to another defensive-minded coach. But maybe those guys did put in a good word. He just didn't fit in their current systems. I don't know. I found that a little curious. Do you think Malone would put in a good word for Jimmer? He just didn't need him? Or how do you think that conversation would have went between Malone and Monty?
Yeah, I definitely believe that they put in a good word for Jimmer. And I'll tell you, you know, the NBA circles are so small, and I think that's what people need to realize too. The Kings waived Jimmer not because they didn't want him around. I mean, basically, if you look at what happened at the end of the season, the Sacramento Kings played out the rest of the year with Ray McCallum as their only point guard. They could have really used Jimmer down the stretch, but because the NBA is a small world and because Rudy Gay and Jimmer Fredette share the same agency, the Sacramento Kings wanted to make sure that Jimmer Fredette was taken care of. That if his agent wanted him bought out and sent on his merry way, that's exactly what was going to happen. The Kings made a decision on October 31st that they were not going to pick up the last year option. They would have owed Jimmer $3.5 million this year. They're already right now like pushing the luxury tax for a 28-win team that may not even win 28 wins this year. So they needed to make sure that everything was okay with Jimmer's people, because Jimmer's people and Rudy Gay's people are the exact same people. And I'm sure they gave a glowing review of him, because you can't give anything but that. He's a hard worker. He's a guy that wants to win, and a guy who is always prepared. There were a couple of games where Jimmer came in and looked a little bit lost, but that was after like five games of DMP CDs. You know, when you gave him consistent minutes, he consistently scored. And I think that's the takeaway from the Kings. They, at the end of the season, Michael Malone would have loved to have had Jimmer Fredette. I mean, because, again, Ray McCallum played, you know, 48 minutes like four straight games. And during the 10 games that Isaiah Thomas was injured, he averaged like 46 minutes a night. And they were running like Travis Outlaw as a backup point guard.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, so do you have any more questions about Jimmer, Michael? Or?
Let's
get on to the guy I don't want to talk about.
Do it.
I view him as kind of the ultimate example of the nondescript NBA wing. John Salmons has played for like 14 seasons or something in the NBA. The guy's been around forever.
Yes.
And the most I remember about him from when he was playing was his scraggly beard. That's what I remember about John Salmons. I don't remember him being a great player in any way, shape, or form in any game I've ever watched. So I'm hoping that you, who he's had, what, three different stops in Sacramento?
And I've been there for
both. You saw some things.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've seen him play night in, night out for years. So tell me what I don't know about John Salmons, and I'll pretend that he's not 30,000 years old and still has all those NBA skills.
Okay, so I'll start out by saying this. While he is so nondescript, and even as a person, he has zero personality. Zero personality for the media. I mean, what you end up doing, I know you talked about a scraggly beard. This is going to sound awkward. While he's talking, there's just so little there that you end up staring deeply into his goatee. We call it the Salmons effect. You just keep getting lost, like, oh my gosh, look, it's twisted. What's going on there? So anyway, let me tell you the good things about John Salmons. Number one, John Salmons comes in each and every year in the best shape of anyone that you have in camp. He sets an incredible example as a veteran who will come in and beat everyone in every single win sprint. He's like an antelope. The Kings have done nothing but rave about him again and again because he sets a standard for working out, for professionalism, for conducting yourself on and off the court. So that's one good thing. Secondly, John Salmons is an above-average defender at multiple positions. He can guard the one, the two, and the three without any problems. As he's gotten older, he's gone away from what really was like trained into him at a young age while he played with Allen Iverson, and that was that, you know, everyone is ball dominant. And so when Tyreke Evans was there, clearly there was going to be an issue because Tyreke Evans is a complete ball dominant player. Again, you guys have a lot of ball dominant players. As John Salmons has aged, he's done a really nice job of becoming a competent three-point shooter. He struggled with the Kings, but I'll say this. If he hits his first shot, then you're a much better team. He's going to hit, you know, 12, 14 points easily. If he misses the first one or two shots, it's over. You might as well put him on the bench and leave him there. He does have the ability to pass. He's not a ridiculously bad rebounder. He does have very, very good post moves if you go to him in that type of situation. But he is getting older. Was he 33, 34 years old?
He's 34, yeah.
Yeah, he's in great shape. He's going to give you everything he's got, and he's not going to say a word. He's probably the quietest player I've ever been around. We have a really quiet guy right now in Sacramento, in Quincy Acey. Very, very quiet and reserved. Well, John Salmons is almost like wallpaper. I mean, he just blends in and hides, whether he had a big game or he had a bad game. There are multiple times where he started to say something, and then he goes, you know what, I don't want to say that, so scratch that. And then he'll start over, and again, it's nondescript. But he's a good teammate. I think most people like being around him. He's not... as he's gotten older, he's not the ball hog he was when he was younger. And again, he defends. He does defend at a very high level. And I'm talking, he can defend big wings. You don't want him going up against LeBron James every game, but he does just fine. I mean, the Kings had him out of position at the three for multiple seasons, playing alongside Kevin Martin. And if you can cover up anything that Kevin Martin does, then you're a genius.
Well, I mean, that's actually what the Pelicans need. I mean, they were the fifth worst defense in the league last year. They need guys who can come in and at least have a clue how to play defense. And considering this is one of the starters had the youngest average age of any team in the NBA last year. So having a veteran who can come in and show how it's done, maybe I'll not dislike John Salmons as much as I did when I first heard the signing.
Well, I think it's very telling last year that the Sacramento Kings were not a good team. We talked about this in Sacramento multiple times, that the biggest disappointments that have ever come through Sacramento over the last 5 years are every single one of their veteran players. I mean, Chuck Hayes came in, they signed him to a huge deal, and then he had a heart problem, so they waived him, or they you know, canceled his contract. Then they re-signed him when his heart problem cleared up. He came in like nine games in, he dislocated his shoulder, and from then on out, he was like 60 pounds overweight. John Salmons, again, did not play particularly well over his last two seasons in Sacramento. You know, guys like Francisco Garcia, Travis Outlaw, I mean, he came to the Kings as like a 27-year-old and just bombed out. I mean, he basically has just been coasting for almost 4 years in Sacramento now. And so... The Kings packaged all these veterans up, you know, Patrick Patterson, who I don't know what the Kings were doing, but, you know, the season before he had found the short porch in the corners and was bombing away and hitting all kinds of threes. Well, Michael Malone doesn't put him in the corner and he's missing all of his shots and everyone's like, what's wrong with Patrick Patterson? It's like, well, 60% of his three-point attempts came from the corners last year. And he shot like four of them this season. So the Kings package, you know, Salmons and Chuck Hayes and Patrick Patterson and Gravis Vasquez, they send him to Toronto, and Toronto goes on to dominate the Eastern Conference with those four guys as their primary bench. And that tells you that they're not bad role players. They're just they're just not guys that you want in your starting lineup. Not one of those four do you want in your starting lineup. They're just not good enough. They're good backups. And they're good role players, but Sacramento has never had a need for role players because everyone is a superstar in Sacramento. And so basically, I'm okay with John Salmons on a team filled with good players. You guys have a lot of nice pieces. He's going to fit in well. He's going to do his job. And he's going to be really quiet about it. And you've got to respect that.
No, I mean, you say he leads by example and he's really quiet with the media. The Pelicans are obviously a very young team. I would say their vocal leader last year was probably Anthony Morrow, and he's gone now. Is Salmons a guy who only leads by examples with players? Is he just as quiet in the locker room with players, or is that just a media thing?
Okay, well, before he was traded last season, we actually did have a couple of moments where Salmons called team meetings and aired differences. I mean, I don't know if you've heard, but the Sacramento Kings have a guy named DeMarcus Cousins who doesn't always get along with everybody in the locker room. You could ask Tyreke Evans about his time with DeMarcus Cousins, and I'm not sure. Tyreke is brutally honest to a point at some times, especially when you catch him in a mood where he's talkative. You need somebody. John is a guy who can sort of, you know, pull guys aside and say, look, professionalism is lacking. Like, I think that gets to him more than, like, bad play. Like, look, we're not being professional. And so I think that is a good thing that you have him. You know, Tyreke Evans has always been a really respectful guy, too, in that sense. And you know, again, you're getting another guy in Jimmer who's very, very good in the locker room. You're not getting one bad locker room guy at all in that mix. So I think John can help out. He can also, what he can do is if there is a leader on your team and they sort of need a guy to have counsel with and then to stand next to him during a point where he needs to stand up and say something to people, John will do that. He is a good team guy, especially at his age. And he keeps himself in such great shape that as long as people want to give John Salmons contracts, I think he'll take them. He'll keep playing until he's 38 if it's allowed. If people, you know, say – if they keep giving him money, he'll keep playing. And it's not for the money. It's because he does – you know, he's a pro's pro. And the other cool thing about John Salmons is he loves playing against Philadelphia guys. So when he goes up against Kobe Bryant, it's on. And so you get some of these matchups throughout the season where you're like, huh, why is John Salmons going nuts? And then you look, and the guy he's going against is from Philly. And all the Philly guys, it's just like the Seattle guys, you know, when you deal with Nate Robinson, Jamal Crawford, Isaiah Thomas, Jason Terry, there's this huge group of Seattle guys. And you're like, why did Nate Robinson go off for 50 tonight? It's like, well, he's playing against Aaron Brooks, another Seattle guy. And so you have these moments. So John does that too, where he really likes to stick it to somebody from Philly.
So Michael made a point in our last podcast where the Pelicans essentially have their top six players. There's no question who they are. And if you look at rotations and minutes, you're really looking for the seventh guy now at this point. But that seventh guy will, you know, unfortunately have the label of starting small forward probably. Unless the team bites the bullet and puts Tyreke as a starting small forward. I'm not sure if they'll do that. At some point, they probably will. But if I was telling you that John Salmons was probably going to come in and soak up 20 minutes as a small forward, probably starting the game, definitely not finishing the game for the Pelicans, would you be at all worried about that, considering what's going to be around him?
No, because you guys do have a great supporting cast. So if all you need him to do is to hit an occasional corner three and to play strong defense, then you're going to be okay. Now, is he the quickest guy at this point in his career? Probably not. I think, honestly, your team is better with Eric Gordon not starting and Tyreke Evans starting at the two, specifically because he's a much stronger defender.
Well, next time you talk to Eric Gordon, let him know that, because he keeps talking about how he's been brought in to be the team leader,
yeah.
Starting guard.
He is a savior type player, I know. Wait, that's what comes with a giant paycheck that you didn't want. I get that. And, you know, and at Summer League, just so you know, Eric Gordon was was in the stand sitting with Chris Mullin, the Sacramento, you know, Vivek Ranadive's right-hand man in Sacramento. He was
really?
Hanging out with Chris Mullin and Pete D'Alessandro at 1.2. So, yeah, you know, Eric Gordon was in Vegas. I don't think he was there to support the team, unless he was, and I just missed that part. But he definitely was working the room a bit. And, you know, for my money, it's like, look, if he wants to show some dedication to the game, then, you know, the sky's the limit. Everyone's always known that about Eric Gordon. But until he decides that he wants to fully be engaged and dedicate himself to the game of basketball, then, you know, he is what he is, right? He's a really, really nice fluff player. He's a guy who's going to fill up stat sheets on a losing team. And until
he's going to fill up one column of a stat sheet.
Well, he'll get you some rebounds, and on occasion he'll get you some assists. I mean, he has potential to do all of those things, but potential is like a four-letter word. So.
Eric Gordon had the second lowest rebound rate of any player in the NBA last year.
Really?
Yeah, he's not even getting rebounds for you.
Yeah.
I know. I'm like one of those guys who I got to have at least a couple columns from a guy to make me think that he's going to be worth something.
Well, and we
like,
had Marcus Thornton. We had Marcus Thornton the last 2 years, which, I mean, he just thought he was a 20-point-a-game guy. And, like, he literally sat there in the same exact spot for, like, the last season and a half waiting for his moment to be a star. It's like you at least have to move around the perimeter from one spot to the next. There is no star at the elbow, the right elbow for any team. You at least have to try to move and do other things. And, you know, so I get what you're saying about Gordon. And he's always had potential, but I think his potential died the day he left the Clippers.
Mm, good for us.
Yeah.
So you touched a little bit on Tyreek now. Of course, the team is talking about him working on his outside shot. You saw a little bit of that in Sacramento the summer of 2012. Worked on his outside shot the next year. You know, his numbers raised both from the mid-range and, you know, quite considerably from three-point range. I guess I have two questions for you. One, watching that day in, day out, did you feel like that was a small sample size and or a fluke thing, or did you see an actual improvement in his form? And my second question for you is, how come nobody has really convinced Tyreek to work on his post game? Because I know you saw it in small pieces in Sacramento. He could just be dominant down there.
Yes.
If it was up to you, would you have him working on his three-point game or his post-game this summer?
If it were up to me, I would never, ever allow him to shoot a three-point shot ever again. I don't know if your listeners know this, but Tyreek Evans was a child prodigy. So, like, when he was four, he was, like, doing crazy and-one video stuff. You know, like dribbling between his legs. You know, when he was in high school, he was one of the best players in the country. And I know for a fact that his brothers blamed John Calipari for messing with his shot. And then, you know, if you look at the lineage of Calipari as he's gone from Memphis to Kentucky, it's that he only wants guys to do one specific thing. So if you trace who Tyreek Evans is now, you can look at the last 5 years of players on Calipari's team, and you can say, look, he is the same exact player that Calipari wanted Michael Kidd-Gilchrist to be. You got me? So what he does is he strips away all the junk, and he says, I'm going to hand you the ball. You're going to run at the rim every single time. And that's the same exact thing we saw from Kidd-Gilchrist. You know, with DeMarcus Cousins and with other big men in Kentucky, he chains them to the basket. So when the Kings get Cousins, all of a sudden he's got, you know, incredible handles. I mean, the way that DeMarcus can contort his body in the post is just incredible. The way he can dribble, he can, you know, take a guy. He can go coast to coast anytime. He's an incredible passer. We saw none of that at Kentucky. All we saw was a post player. And I think that Calipari stripped down guys a lot. And then when Tyreek came to Sacramento, he was allowed to do so many things as a rookie, and then they slowly scaled those things back. And they tried everything to work with his jumper. To me, his jumper is a lost cause. He's a sweet guy. I really like him. I like his brothers, too. They're good people. But they need to give up on the jumper. That, like, during the season one year, they brought in Keith Vaney, who's called the Shot Doctor. And he, I don't know, he hit like 800 three-pointers in college. And they had him work with Tyreek in season. And there's nothing you can do. Tyreek falls away on every single shot. And he cocks his upper body back. Not even like it's not even like a standard fall away. It's a strange cocking of the chest, and it throws them all off. And some games he'll catch fire and he'll hit a bunch, but then there's other games where he just completely falls apart. Where the Kings really tried to work with him, and even Jeff Petrie, who's again one of the greatest shooters in the 70s that the NBA had. He tried to work with him on a mid-range game, on a stop and pop, because Tyreek is so strong and so agile that when he's running at you, you're absolutely done. If it's you and a rim and against Tyreek Evans, you're going to lose every single time because he's so strong. And the Kings tried to work on him diving to the basket, stopping, pulling back, and hitting a jump shot, and even that didn't work. He just really struggled. Then he had plantar fasciitis. And it just really fell apart. I think at this point what you have is a guy that if you gave him the ball and just said, go get me 20 points every game by running at the rim, you're going to get it. And he's going to average 5 or 6 rebounds. He's going to average, you know, 4.5, 5 assists a game. And he'll find other people. But he really has a narrow court vision. He really doesn't have a gigantic basketball IQ. He's a really good man-on defender when his man has the ball. When his man doesn't have the ball, he's waiting for a bus. So he's just standing there, his knees are locked. He's got an umbrella in his hand. He's just, like, looking down the street, seeing what's happening. As soon as his man has the ball, he's an incredible man-on defender. But he loses his man all the time. And so he has some flaws. And I know Monty Williams is a great coach. And he's probably a better coach than Paul Westphal or Keith Smart ever were for Tyreek Evans. But, you know, I just don't know that some of the issues that Tyreek has are fixable. They are who he is. So I would make him run at the rim all day long and then say, hey, look, dude, you got to kick it out. You got to kick it out to some of these other guys, which is sort of the reason why I don't think it works particularly well in New Orleans, because you already have a guy in Drew Holiday. You already have a guy in Eric Gordon that can kind of do that same thing, but they also have a few other skills.
Well, there is this one fact about Tyreek Evans that makes me feel good about what I saw from him last year. He actually took the ball. He shot a shot closer than 10 feet on 79.5% of his shots, closer? Which is the lowest rate of close 10 feet or closer. On only 20% of his shots came outside of 10 feet.
Yeah.
Which is the lowest rate of his career. So clearly Monty's been telling him, rim, get there.
You know, and I can't wait for Monty to tell that to Omer Asik, because his stats outside of 3 feet are so ungodly that you're like, oh my gosh, he shoots like 24% outside of 10 feet, something like that. Yeah. So, but anyway, go ahead. I agree with what you're saying. If Tyreek Evans is listening to directions, and if they tell him to do what you did at Kentucky, run at the rim, or do what you did at Memphis, run at the rim every single time, you can't stop him. You know, he's a lot like Manu Ginobili without the 3-point shot.
Yeah, I agree, and I'll add the post. I mean, when I first started studying Tyreek his last season with you guys, he was getting fouled on 40% of his post-up possessions.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do anything. If you're too slow, he has that little baseline spin. If you're too small, he'll just back you down. I've never understood why I could see him being a better version of Bonzi Wells. And that's what Bonzi Wells couldn't shoot, but Bonzi Wells was a power guard who could get you in. I mean, imagine Bonzi Wells with Tyreek Evans's handle. I just don't understand why teams don't put him in the post. But such is life. People will keep trying to improve that jumper to no avail. The last guy to talk to you about, we don't know. We're assuming he's not going to be a Pelican, but he was another guy who started off in Sacramento, actually played really well his first couple of years. Omri Caspi, I guess, if he does stay with the Pelicans, and he is a guy that could eat up some minutes at the small forward position, what could he give a team?
I really like Omri Caspi, honestly. Another very nice guy. A long list of players in Sacramento that were frustrated with the lack of passing. So when it was Tyreek and Beno Udrah, it was always from Omri. It was like, look, dude, I don't care that Tyreek doesn't pass. I get it. You know, we're going to get 5 assists out of him a game, and all of them are straight up, you know, his assist. The passes that he made usually equal assists. So it's not like Tyreek Evans had 15 passes that equaled 5 assists. He had like 7 passes that equaled 5 assists because he's so strong and people collapse and he finds a guy who's right there for a dunk. So the difference, and then on top of that, they had Beno Udrah, who had 5 assists, and the same thing. All Beno wanted to do was pull up and drop in the 15-foot jumper. He was great at it, you know, and the backcourt was really solid, except for the other, you know, 11 guys on the team just completely felt left out. And it's still what haunts the Sacramento Kings today, is that 3 guys scored, you know, 60 points a game, and the rest of the guys got chump change. And so when I look at Omri Caspi, what I see is, number one, he's a guy who can shoot a corner 3. He has a very, very quick shot. He can get it off anywhere. He can take you off the dribble on occasion, but he's an inline driver. He's not Tyreek Evans. He doesn't have a crossover and a spin move. He either goes right at the rim or he stays where he's at. He can pass a little bit, but it's not something he looks to do. He can rebound extremely well. What I liked him as a young player that I thought he could develop into was like a poor man Sean Marion. He's got an awkward shot like Marion, but he's also got a very, very quick first step, and he's a quick leaper. And so he had the potential to be a really good rebounder, but I think as his career has progressed, he's become more of a specialist. You know, especially if you look at the Rockets take guys and they set him in the corner. Even, you know, the only guy who's allowed to freelance at all out of that corner is Chandler Parsons, and now he's gone. But sort of that type of player, just a stripped down version of. And I like Caspi. He was a disaster in Cleveland. And not only that, but the Sacramento Kings will be paying for that trade for the rest of their lives, where they traded Caspi and a lottery protected number one for J.J. Hickson. So literally the Kings can't trade their first round pick until 2017. And they waived Hickson before the trade deadline that same season, because Hickson was the biggest nightmare of all time. So, I mean, they will literally pay for that. They cannot trade it. Even right now, they love to have Josh Smith. They'd love to get in on this Kevin Love action, but they can't trade a first round pick because it literally like 6 years locked up. Because of the Stepien rule. So
are you saying that the Kings are going to be in the lottery until 2017?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's still a top 10 protected pick this year. And I have a tough time believing that they won't be in the lottery this year. So, it's difficult. I mean, the worst thing you can do, right, is trade for Josh Smith and $13.5 million and then win 37 games and be the 11th pick and lose your pick. That would be the worst thing that they could do.
Darren Collison put up 19-9 as a starter in New Orleans.
Yeah. But he lost his job to a 36-year-old Mike James in Dallas 1 year, and then Dallas went on to finish 14-6 the rest of the way.
Yep.
Yeah. So, again, you guys know more about Collison than I do. Like,
I'm just trying to help you out here.
Yeah. So I hope that I've given you some insight to these guys, because what you did got you what the Pelicans did do, they added 4 really good guys. I mean, Tyreek Evans, he's a really, really good kid. And John Salmons is quiet he's a good guy. And Jimmer Fredette, they're salt of the earth. There aren't better people in the league than Jimmer Fredette. And, you know, and Omri, he's a good kid. Maybe he can be misled on occasion. Maybe he has some strange ideals. Again, he was in the Israeli army as part of his, you know, it's mandatory. So he does have background in the military. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was a sniper in the military. I don't think he actually got to the point where he was actually in war, but he was trained that way. So, I mean, you have to look at these guys and say that you added pieces that can help your team, but not as, you know, Omri Caspi as a starting small forward for the Sacramento Kings, or Tyreek Evans as a starting point guard or two guard, or John Salmons as a starting small forward. When you put them in starting roles, you're going to fail. When you have them as, you know, your 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then you're not a bad team. I mean, it's what we saw in Toronto. Again, Pete D'Alessandro has said, we had a lot of really, really nice backups. What we don't have are a lot of really nice starters. And I think he's right. And I think a lot of those guys, outside of Tyreek Evans, which I do believe could be and should be a starter on that team, I think everyone else, you know, is better suited coming off the bench.
All right. Last thing I got for you, just because our fans aren't going to believe it if we say it. Of course, the Josh Smith rumors started heating up again. Sacramento was looking for a third team. Pelicans fans came up with this fantasy of Josh Smith to Sacramento, Eric Gordon to Detroit, and Rudy Gay to New Orleans. Can you tell all of our listeners that that has a 0% chance of happening?
Yeah, that is a 0% chance. The Sacramento Kings love Rudy Gay. They believe that, okay, let me put it in the simplest, like, straight line thinking. Rudy Gay was horrible and a bust, and everyone thought he was a bad basketball player. When he was traded to Sacramento, not only did they revive him and make him look really good, but in doing so, they became geniuses as well.
Yeah,
and so, they're not going to let him go because he made them look like they really did something smart here.
Right. They were at his door begging him to take $18 million. They're not
19.3.
Yeah, they're not. Yeah. They're not including him in a trade to get Josh Smith. I want to say it because, of course, you know, fans have pipe dreams. I want them to hear it from you.
Well, and you know what? I think the Sacramento Kings and the Pelicans could actually make a good trade or two together. I think they do have rosters that actually make sense to make some deals, but that's not one of them. Like, I mean, if the rumors were right and Ryan Anderson was available, I think Ryan Anderson going home to Sacramento where he's from makes a lot of sense. I think the Kings could put together a package that maybe wouldn't wow you, but when you're looking at guys who all of a sudden become like, I mean, Ashik is going to start and Anthony Davis is going to start, so Ryan Anderson becomes, you know, almost like a luxury. I think adding a guy like Jason Thompson to that team, who is a versatile big who can play the four or the five, it actually makes a lot of sense. And people who go, oh my gosh, Jason Thompson. Jason Thompson is a lot better player than what people think, and he's a lot better player than what we've seen in the last 2 years. The fact is, him and DeMarcus Cousins, A, don't get along, and B, he's a very poor man's version of. I'm not saying he's like DeMarcus Cousins. He's an all-around big, not a specialist big. So when you bring in, you know, Ashik, he's a specialist big. All he does is play defense, and he does that really, really well. Well, the Kings don't have that guy. All they have is two guys who are all-around type players, and whether they're high-end all-around type players like DeMarcus Cousins or medium all-around players, it doesn't matter. They still don't have a shot blocker. They still don't have a natural, like, crazy defensive rebounder until they traded for Reggie Evans. So, I think the Kings and the Pelicans could come up with a couple of deals. Even a guy like Reggie Evans could really help your team as like a a strong come in and lead and do the dirty work type stuff for 10, 12, 15 minutes a game. And so I think that there's a possibility that the two teams could work something out, but the Josh Smith stuff is crazy talk, and the Kings have a trade exemption that they now think that they can use, or Jason Terry's expiring deal, or Derek Williams' expiring deal. Derek Williams, another player that might be able to help your specific team. Is he better than John Salmons at the small forward position? Maybe he is. I don't know. But, you know, I think that there could be something worked out there. I just don't think it has nothing to do with Rudy Gay. Expect Rudy Gay to sign a four-year extension between now and October 1st. That's what I would expect.
Well, there you go. I will say I think everybody on this podcast thanks you and will have loved you for the first 45 minutes. You ever suggest a Ryan Anderson for Jason Thompson trade again, Ryan might block you.
Oh, and by the way, the Kings have no first-round pick to sweeten that deal.
Yeah, you could throw in McLemore and Stauskas. We still wouldn't be interested, but
yeah.
And you wouldn't, so. But, yeah, so.
Yeah, as soon as you said Ryan Anderson, my pencil snapped in half.
Well, McLemore. I mean, you guys love Ryan Anderson, right? And
I love Ryan Anderson.
And, you know, the biggest mistake the Kings ever made, they had Ryan Anderson in Sacramento, and they let him walk out the door, and then they re-signed Jason Thompson. Ryan Anderson was ready to stay in Sacramento, was ready to sign in Sacramento, because that's where he's from. He's from the Sacramento area. He played high school basketball there. He loves the Kings. He would have signed in a heartbeat, and they let him walk out the door. And that's the whole Thomas Robinson, Damian Lillard, yeah. So
fun summer. Yeah.
Painful moments.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate all the insight.
Anytime, guys. Anytime you need it.
All right, Michael. So after listening to that, John Salmons, in case anybody isn't aware, John Salmons was – Michael had him on – I'll give him credit. He had him on his list of small forwards that were available. I was not even considering that as a guy who's coming to this team. Salmons has never been – my favorite player. So hearing that, I guess I could feel a little better. How do you feel about John Salmons after talking to...
Yeah, I think there's two different things here. I think, one, he wouldn't have been on mine, Michael McNamara, as fake GM, top five list for guys I would have went after, but I don't know.
Well, you just listed a bunch of free agent forwards in our last conversation. I remember Salmons was in
there. Yeah.
I specifically remember because I kind of laughed to myself when he said it.
I guess my thing is, and this is where I've kind of transitioned. I don't know if I've matured or if I'm just too tired of playing the game, but I don't really have the interest anymore in talking about what I would have rather done or who I would have picked instead. Like, to me, that's just a futile game that, you know. I see the appeal in it because you could come back at the end of the year and look smart. And if you don't, you don't mention anything about it. But I've been much more curious with this Salmons thing about, okay, this wasn't a guy that I would have signed, but what were Dell and Monty thinking? Like, you know, they sought him out. Rumors were that maybe they went after a guy like Allen Anderson too, like a more veteran wing player. And I don't care as much about, you know, postulating about who I would have picked instead, because that will never matter. I'm more interested in why Dell and Monty focused in on this guy. So if you had to theorize of the conversations going on in that room with the small forwards that were available for about the same amount of money in that, why do you think they went after a John Salmons and an Allen Anderson and those type of guys?
Well, probably because they are needing a veteran player on this team in the locker room. I mean, that's always brought up that, you know, we're bringing in a veteran for the locker room. The Pelicans didn't have a lot of money to spend. Like, you brought up Sean Marion last time. I didn't really think Sean Marion's going to accept that much money, at least not very early. Maybe like in a month, if no one's come and offered him $3 to $4 million, he might take a lower amount. But I don't know, just looking at what's out there, they wanted a guy. I didn't know that much about John Salmons in the locker room, the fact that he you know, he comes in the greatest shape of his life and he's that good of a locker room presence. So if you're looking around, I mean, they talk to Mike Malone. I'm sure Monty and him still speak all the time. So I guess that's the answer, is they're looking for a guy who can come into this locker room and set an example.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think,
and he could shoot.
Yeah, I mean that's something that's missing here. Is if you just go look at his statistics, it'll be very hard to find anything that you like. The two things I could hang my hat on is on his catch and shoot three pointers. He was at 42.6%, which, you know, right now the Pelicans have six guys who were 41.7% or higher from catch and shoot threes. And the reason why I settled on that exact number is because the sixth best guy actually is Ryan Anderson.
Right.
At 41.7. I mean, they have a lot of...
They have a crazy team when it comes to catch and shoot 3 points.
Right. So, I mean...
Which is why I all season long I was flabbergasted by the fact that they took so few of them. But continue. Sorry,
so,
to interrupt.
So, I mean, Salmons is good there. He's also the other place where you would possibly get excited is he's 47% from the corners.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to justify it. I don't care. Yeah, there would have been other guys I would have signed, but that's pointless to go into. If I'm trying to look at it from what they saw, I think it's a couple things. I think, yeah, it's the veteran leadership. I think it's the spot-up shooting where if you could take away the 100 possessions that he was in the pick-and-roll last year and the 50 or so isolation possessions, if you could make him just a spot-up shooter if he accepts that role, I think you'll have a fairly efficient player. I think the other thing is the other side of the ball, and we've seen that in Monty's system, it takes guys, you know, especially the younger they are, a little longer to pick up the defensive system. Well, if the whole point of this signing is to get a stopgap guy for 1 year, why would you want to spend half of that year teaching him the defensive system only to see him leave? You know, you look at guys like a Wesley Johnson or a Jordan Hamilton who are probably more talented, just raw talent players in their career right now than Salmons. I wouldn't, you know, even begin to debate that. But, you know, if the learning curve for Salmons is maybe a couple of weeks to pick up the defensive system with all of his experience in the NBA, and it's a couple of months for some of the younger guys, you know, why wouldn't you bring that in? Again, I think this is the thought process. Is it possible that they picked the wrong guy? Yeah, I'm sure at the end of the year we're going to look back and four small forwards, or maybe even more, who all signed for around the same money or less, probably will have put up better individual stats somewhere else. But you can't assume that would have happened here, and it's a different role. And, you know, I say this all the time, the 2007-2008 Hornets, one of the most impactful players on that team was PJ Brown. Now you go look up that team, PJ Brown was not on the team that year. But what he provided, you know, in the locker room seasons before that helped guys like David West get over the hump and learn how to be professional. So there's all these other things that we just don't know about and can't quantify on basketballreference.com that, whether I agree with it or not, that's my logic on Dell, you know, how Dell and Monty probably came to that decision.
Right. And so then let me ask you this question. Why Jimmer Fredette?
I mean, again, we get back to the catch and shoot, 3-point shootings, 50% from there. And I think they've liked these kind of reclamation projects going back to Marco. I mean, you see a trend with Marco Bellinelli, Anthony Morrow, now Jimmer Fredette. You have these guys who are just, you know, pure shooters that have some other gaps in their game that maybe got the raw end of the stick at, you know, in other places, and now they come and they get a shot here. You know, I would say Marco and Anthony Morrow panned out pretty well. I think at that point they were looking at a 15th, you know, 14th or 15th contract they were about to give in, depending on whether they had agreed with Patrick Young by then or not. And how many, you know, how many guys had the upside of Jimmer that were sitting there that were willing to take a minimum contract? I mean, I think it's a very low risk, maybe medium reward proposition where, you know, if they could do the same thing they did with, you know, Marco and Anthony Morrow kind of in bounce back years and having a very specific thing that they provide, you know, I don't think there was many guys with the upside that could have been had for, you know, a minimum contract.
You want to know why I think Jimmer Fredette's here?
I want to.
I think he's Brian Roberts.
So this has been kind of a popular theory that, you know, when I honestly didn't connect the dots at all. I had just done my rotation column a couple days before. A lot of people, when they saw this Jimmer news, immediately they went to the, does this mean Austin Rivers is getting traded or cut? I didn't make that connection at all. It sounds like you have. Where do you see that connection?
Well, no, I didn't make that connection. I don't think that because Fredette's here that... So, let me put this...
What's his name?
Fredette?
Fredette? Oh, God.
Did I say Fredette?
Yeah, just for one little... I love it. Fredette.
I'm the worst at names in the world, in case you haven't noticed.
No, I thought it was brilliant if people go
so
listen.
So, Jameer Fredette. So, anyways, I don't believe – I don't think that this makes Austin Rivers be tradable, I mean, any more than he already is. I think that Dell Demps would be perfectly willing to move Austin Rivers if it got him something that he wanted. That doesn't change. If Jimmer didn't come and there was some other guard signed and brought in, I mean, it's not unusual that a team has six guards on a roster of 15. I mean, that's what you kind of want. You want six guards – then six forwards and then three centers, something along those lines. So it's not surprising that they brought in Jimmer, and it's not like we should immediately assume that, oh, Jimmer's there and Russ is there, so therefore Austin Rivers must be gone. No. But Jimmer is Brian Roberts. He is a guy, his assist rate's a little bit lower than Brian Roberts are, but they're pretty similar. Jimmer does the same sort of shooting off the bounce. He is a guy who can create shots for himself. And I think that Monty has a value in having that guy. I mean, I don't have to tell you this. Do you think Jimmer Fredette is going to be noticeably worse on defense than Brian Roberts was?
I don't know if that's possible.
So if you're going to put Fredette out there, you're going to end up with the exact same sort of thing. You're going to end up with a guard who's probably going to be looking for his own shot. And maybe Monty wants that in places. He wants a guy who will create some havoc and carry a little bit of a load at times. And he went out there and said, well, we can't sign Brian Roberts. He is going to get more money than, you know, a bunch of other guys. But for, you know, Jimmer's out there and he's a minimum contract. Let's go grab that guy. And what is the, I mean, he has a better PER than Roberts did. He's a better shooter than Roberts. His true shooting percentage is significantly better. And if you just look at, like, numbers per 40, the only thing Roberts is better than him is assists, but it's, like, at 0.6 more per 40 minutes. So I just feel like they have that type of role that they want on their team, and Jimmer was the best option out there for a minimum contract.
Yeah, well, it also can't hurt to have to be able to have a guy you could just put in at the end of the games when you know the other team's going to foul. that's going to be lights out, similar to what Roberts was. But yeah, see, you know, I don't know if I saw this specific signing coming, but I saw another guard being added when everybody was thinking it was going to be, you know, just small forwards added to the roster again. When I did my rotation article, for those who haven't seen it, I tried to sit down and based on what Monty has done in the past, look at his substitution patterns and try to figure out the rotations. And the second that John Salmons was signed, to me, the thing that signaled more than anything was that not only would Tyreek start at small forward, but he was going to get the majority of his minutes at small forward this season. I just don't think you could play Salmons more than 20 minutes. So to me, you know, once I figured that, okay, now with this team, Tyreek Evans is pretty much a small forward. Well, then who's there left at guard? I got a guy in Rivers who the team's trying to make almost purely a point guard. At least that's what they said at the end of last year. A guy in Russ Smith who, watching Summer League, there was a lot of good, but you just know Monty Williams is not going to trust that guy with all the mistakes he makes. So really, where were the other guards? I saw a definite spot for a guard there. Jimmer was a little smaller than I anticipated, but it really does fit a lot of the catch and shoot stuff. I do see some similarities in his game with Roberts, but you know, Roberts was much more mid-range. Jimmer has, you know, far deeper range than Brian did. I don't know. I guess I was going to say this, but I'll ask you this right now. We have 15 guys reportedly. Not everything's official, but, you know, it looks like Caspi's going to be out. Miller's going to be signed as well. Patrick Young announced a two-year contract. We have 15 guys right now. Everybody's healthy. Who do you think the two inactives are to start the season?
Russ Smith and Darius Miller.
Really? So we go with all those big guys. Okay.
Yeah. Let me ask you then who you think it is, because you think Darius Miller will be active.
So let me
come clean there. I am not a Darius Miller believer. Sorry, Darius, all your fans who listen out there. I'm not a Darius Miller believer. He may be, so me putting him at the bottom of the roster is just how I think. Probably because we don't have so many small forwards that could play that position, he might be active, but I would expect him to be one of the bottom two.
Yeah, I think it's between Withy and Young. One of those two would be inactive. And then between Fredette and Russ Smith. I mean, I don't really see how Jimmer is in this rotation if we're even somewhat healthy.
What if he beats out Austin Rivers?
Yeah, see, I can't. I
You don't think that's going to happen?
No, I mean, because Austin, you have the defense, you have you have similar spot up shooting. Again, I mean, as James was talking about, there are a lot of things that Jimmer can do, but sometimes having a guy who could do more things is worse. Like, you just want specialists, especially when you have so many dynamic players on this roster. You know, I would pray that John Salmons never dribbles the ball this season. Like, literally never dribbles. Catch and shoot or swing pass it. Those are the only – and then in some ways, same with Jimmer. I mean, I know that he is capable of other things, but on any single possession, do I want him in a pick and roll over – you know, having Anthony Davis facing up or Tyreek Evans going to the basket? I mean, at this point, I would be very happy with just specialists. If one of the six main guys, well, other than Oshik on offense, if one of the five other main guys want to do something to create some offense, good for them. But I just want a bunch of specialists. And, you know, Rivers, I think, could give you the similar spot-up shooting, but it's going to give you much better defense. You know, as well. So I can't see him beating out Austin Rivers. I would say there would be some value in Russ Smith being active over Jimmer, only because imagine a 2-minute stretch where, you know, I could just put Russ Smith out there to hound some opposing point guard or to deny him the ball if he's getting in a rhythm and let somebody else bring it up. You know, I could see some value in having Russ Smith active. I could really see a situation in which Jimmer is one of the inactives when everybody's healthy.
It could be. And, I mean, it's you're one in 8 or 9 man rotation in the NBA. I mean, maybe 10 if you're really getting crazy. So that means there's going to be 5 players on this team, which we're going to spend way too much time talking about, who aren't going to play very much.
And I will say I agree with that, but it is nice to know that when injuries occur, that, you know, that there'll be some depth, that there'll be a Luke Babbitt there if Ryan Anderson has to miss a couple games, or, you know, Alexei Ajinka, who I honestly think will improve somewhat over the summer. I mean, it's nice to know that there is some depth. I just want to finish real quick with Miller, because it looks like, you know, when it looked like Caspi was going to be waived, people were saying, you know, why Caspi or why Salmons over Caspi. But it looks like the decision was always Miller or Caspi. You would have went with Caspi, right?
That's true, yeah. I think Caspi's proven that he can play at a higher level than Darius. But, you know, what did we hear all last year, all during the season even, from the coaching staff of the Pelicans? They loved Darius Miller. They loved how he came in and how he worked at stuff. And, I mean, that hasn't gone away. They didn't do a turnover of their coaching squad. So I'm sure that Dell went to them and said, hey, you know, you guys want Darius back? Or it was probably a consideration. And he's familiar with what the team's doing. You don't have to train somebody new.
Yeah, not only do you not have to train him, but he could pull aside somebody. And, mm-hmm. You know, while the other coaches are talking, you know, he could be almost a coach for somebody who's coming in fresh. Yeah, I mean, he had a couple of nice games later in the season. But, yeah, I think they eventually went with the guy that they knew over, you know, for those of you, some of you have been following it closely. Caspi's had some issues politically and, you know, he'll probably get a spot in the NBA this year, but I mean, it could rub some guys the wrong way. And just to be clear on why the Pelicans would trade for him and then, you know, waive him, it was just to make salaries work. It doesn't appear at all that Caspi was somebody that they were interested in. So it was just salary purposes. And again, nothing absolutely official, but it looks like he'll be waived.
The Rockets needed to move him. And I mean, if they wanted to clear extra space, they threw him in that trade because there was room for it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it worked. And then the last guy with the small forward position is, you know, we heard that Luke Babbitt was working on his footwork, looking to be able to guard small forwards. Do you think that we'll be able to see him getting any minutes at small forward this season?
Possibly, but, you know, Luke Babbitt isn't going to guard anything, whether it's a small forward or a power forward. So, you know, he's there to stretch the floor and cause some mismatch problems on the other end of the floor, and you hope that his defensive shortcomings aren't going to be that glaring. That's just the reality of Luke Babbitt. And his offensive ability, I mean, he is enough of a threat, people stay on him. I mean, there are always so many scrambling out to get to him, and he has games where he lights things up. Though I will say, I was watching the wonderful 11-minute long video of James Harden's horrible defense, and you know who popped out like as a big star in that 11 minutes of James Harden being terrible? Luke Babbitt. He had like 10 great plays against James Harden. And the funny part is those were like a few of the plays I really remember of. I was like, wow, Luke's got some good footwork out there. And then you realize just how bad the guy defending him was. Maybe he's not what I thought he was.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question people keep asking then is do you agree with me or what are your thoughts? Who starts at small forward this season in your opinion?
I don't think that Tyreek Evans will start the season at the small forward. But I think he will at some point take that spot over. I think that probably Salmons will start the season at the small forward, but at some point he won't keep it.
And, I mean, what do you think is going to be the thinking behind that as far as why they don't just go with Gordon and Tyreek on the wings to start?
because I really think they like the idea of being able to pull two monster pieces of firepower off the bench. It's how many teams can say that? I mean, and if you really think about it, we have six good players. If you could start the game with four of them and a filler, you should be you should have more than enough firepower to be able to keep the teams even or even gain the lead. And then you throw Ryan Anderson and Tyreek out there against backups. The one consideration I can see about this is that, like, last year they just look at last year and say, in the end, you know, Tyreek as a starter was so much better than Tyreek as a bench player. But I mean then you run into the whole Eric Gordon thing. So are they going to bite the bullet and say, we got to play Gordon and Tyreek Evans together, although Tyreek Evans isn't really a small forward in size and maybe in rebounding abilities? He's not the ideal small forward, and I don't see them biting the bullet and just. I think they're going to try to hope that John Solomons can hold it down for the first 6 minutes of the first quarter and the first 6 minutes of the second quarter, and then Tyreek can be out there doing what he needs to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, you said he's not the ideal small forward, but if I was arguing with that person, I would say, well, John Solomons is. Yeah. And I guess my thing is looking around the Western, because no matter what quote-unquote position Tyreek is playing, he's going to be the same guy on offense, right?
Yeah,
he's got the ball in his hands. He's going to be attacking the rim, occasionally kicking out, whatever. So we're just talking about defense now. Now, people bring up Kevin Durant and LeBron and Melo. Well, let's just focus on the Western Conference and let's not act like anybody could cover Kevin Durant. So I take Kevin Durant away. Who else in the Western Conference? The ball's about to be thrown up. Tyreek Evans is the starting small forward. Who else in the Western Conference are you going, uh-oh, that guy's going to have a night against us?
From the small forward position? Like as a big scorer?
Well, I'm saying,
I mean, I could think of like Batum could cause you some issues, and
so you're
Tyreek's not going to bother him size wise.
So now you're going to be worried that we're playing against Portland, they're going to isolate Batum on Tyreek, and we're done for. Like,
no,
what
but,
worries you so much about Tyreek at small forward? I guess I'm asking.
So what worries me? I think that there are people who play at the small forward position. Who are versatile enough that they can cause issues to any team playing them if their defender is not particularly attentive. And that's just the way the small forward position generally works. Unless you have like LeBron and Carmelo and Durant, where they're the focus of your offense, small forward positions are there to fill in all the gaps. They're there to move the ball. They're there to be there in the corner to finish a play if you know your primary ball handlers are you know need an outlet. And that makes it a dangerous position if you got a kind of lackadaisical off the ball defender.
So this is interesting. You go the other way because most people have been afraid of Tyreek on the ball against some of the...
I would be more comfortable putting Tyreek Evans on the ball against LeBron James and Kevin Durant than any other small forward on this team.
So you're more worried about how he gets lost off the ball, and you'd have a guy like Parsons, Batum, Kawhi Leonard taking advantage of that.
That's absolutely true.
Okay, but I mean, he's going to be a finisher, right, at the end of games?
Uh-huh.
So he's going to have to do that at some point anyway. Right?
He is. Yeah, I mean, there's no way you're getting away from it. And on this team, we have two high-caliber wings, and there's no way you can get away from that fact. There are two high-caliber wings, and that's it. So you got to play your two wings, Gordon and Evans. And they got to play together.
Which brings me to another question I have. Could you at least make the argument that last year, not the best player, but the hardest player to replace on this roster was Ryan Anderson? Not the best player, but hardest to replace. You know, think about the whole roster when healthy at the beginning of the year. Could you make the argument that plucking Ryan Anderson out of it would be the hardest to replace?
Last year, yes. And this year, yes.
Oh.
Yeah. I'll agree with that in both situations. Like, you got to remember, they tried at the beginning of the year to use Jason Smith as Ryan Anderson.
Yes.
And, of course, it didn't work out. I mean, the offense was not fantastic with Jason Smith spacing.
See, I don't agree. I was going to go somewhere else. I agree it was Ryan Anderson last year. To me, this year, I'm going a totally different direction, and it was based on what you just said of, you know, you pluck Ryan Anderson out now, you could give more minutes to AD and Ashik and just play a more defensive game. You know, Babbitt could give you some of the shooting. You've got other good bigs. When I was trying to figure out the rotations and the minutes, I said to myself, what guy, you know, would kind of be like that, the horrible Jenga block that you pull out that just makes it all crumple down? And when I started thinking, okay, if Jrue Holiday gets hurt, who takes his 34 minutes? And I pieced it together, and same with Anthony Davis or Ashik or whatever. And of course, you don't want to lose any of those guys, but I saw ways that you could, you know, replace a lot of the production or shift, you know, what the team would become. I think about pulling Tyreke Evans, and I had him projected at 38 minutes, but anywhere between 34 and 38. I think about pulling his minutes out, and I can't figure out how to kind of construct this team to make it, you know, resemble anywhere near what it would be with him. I think I can make the argument that he will be the hardest guy to replace if he goes down with injury, even harder than AD.
I don't buy that. I think Eric Gordon can give you 80% of Tyreke Evans, and then you can space, because Gordon right now is being relegated probably half the possessions to just a spacer shooter. So if you turn Gordon into more of a ball handler attacker, and don't anyone think I'm saying that Eric Gordon is going to be anywhere near as excellent as Tyreke Evans at that particular role, but you could replace that.
Tell me what you do for 48 minutes at small forward, and tell me who's your finishing five if Tyreke is out.
Well, if you're finishing five with Tyreke out, you have Ashik, Anderson, Davis, Gordon, and Jrue, and you hope that nobody's murdering you on the wing.
You honestly could see a scenario in which Anderson, Ashik, and Davis are finished.
I think you limit your finishing 5 minutes, but I think your final five players for the last 2 to 3 minutes of the game are those five guys.
I don't think it's worth getting into for 10 minutes, but I couldn't disagree more. First of all, I don't see Ashik on the court very much at the end of the games, in large part because of the free throw shooting, and usually because other teams are going small at the end of the game as well. But I'm telling you, thinking about it, I mean, again, if I pull Anthony Davis out, which is a nightmare, and he's obviously the best player, I could still go with Jrue, Gordon, Tyreke, Ryan Anderson, and Ashik. I mean, I still, almost anybody else I pull out, you know, I pull out Jrue Holiday, I have Tyreke Evans as the ball handling point, depending on whatever. I just think he's the guy that
covers all the holes.
Well, he's the
wallpaper.
Who else has his skill set? Like, other skill sets I could pick in from other places. Who else could just be that, you know, dominant and get to the rim at will and be a one-man fast break? That's something that, going back and watching those old games and thinking about Ashik and Anthony Davis grabbing rebounds and throwing outlet passes, I mean, Tyreke Evans is the only guy on this team that could just be a one-man fast break and get you easy points that way. Again, I don't think he's the best player, but looking at how the roster is constructed, he's the one that I'm most afraid of getting injured because, again, what am I doing for 48 minutes at small forward, and how am I going to finish games? So, I don't know. I think it's just something interesting to watch, but he's going to have to stay healthy because, that small forward position.
So basically you're reversing yourself. Before it was like, oh, well, the seventh man doesn't matter that much. But it sounds to me like the seventh man could matter a whole hell of a lot because there's nothing behind Tyreek.
Well, yeah, I've always said the seventh man doesn't matter at all when, you know, you don't have to factor in injuries. But if injuries happen, yeah, I mean, if you remove Tyreek, I think that it could be, you know, you might be in a little bit of trouble, but I think you're going to need all hands on deck at that point. I mean, maybe you go a lot of three guard rotations. Maybe you play, you know, Rivers, Russ, and Gordon for sure. I don't know.
Just put Jrue Holiday in at small forward.
I mean, he could cover some. Again, when I look at this Western Conference, I'm not as scared as a lot of other people. I mean, if you're talking
about Rudy, Rudy Gay is going to tear us apart.
He's honestly, I think, the second best small forward in the West at creating his own. And the other thing,
Chandler Parsons?
At creating his own shot. No, I would
Nick Young?
Yeah, right. I would say Rudy could elevate over guys. He could go into the. I would say he's the second best, and that's my exact point. Is if teams are going to see Tyreek Evans as a weakness, which I don't think he is, but they're going to start running their offense now through that guy. It's not something I'm worried about. And the other thing is, people always think that defense comes down to a one-on-one thing. Honestly, when you're a perimeter defender, you know, it's the guys that are behind you that allow you to play the way that you play. You know, and Kevin Durant is going to be reading that second line of defense because, honestly, if Durant has a good defender on him, all you got to do is send a pick his way, and that guy is gone. It's more about who you have at the rim, and I think with Davis and Ashik at the rim, you could cover up, you know, a lot of maybe one-on-one deficiencies. But I don't know. I think Tyreek definitely starts there. I think he gets the majority of his minutes there. And, I don't think guys like Darius Miller or Luke Babbitt really see any rotation minutes when we're healthy.
I'm hoping not. I really am. I want to see my big six playing lots and lots of minutes and then just see cameos from other guys.
Yeah, I guess the only other thing is we talked about this and kind of joked at Summer League, you know, that people would kind of get attached to some summer league guys. The rotation is set at 15. Do you see the Pelicans bringing in any of these other, you know, any of the guys that were on our summer league team? Or do you think the roster's pretty much set here with the guys? I mean, could you see a situation in which, you know, we bring in another wing player and maybe get rid of a Withy or a Babbitt?
I think it all depends. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Withy was sent somewhere else, but what are you going to get for him, really? And so there have been times in the past where Hornets/Pelicans have brought in, like, they've had like 18 people in camp and then they cut people as they went. But those seasons are always seasons where they're in transition. And this team isn't in transition. It's trying to establish consistency. And I'll be honest, I'll be really surprised if anybody other than the guys that are right now under contract are in the Pelicans training camp. Because, like, even, like, I say they offered Courtney Fells a chance to come in. He's not stupid. He's going to look at the roster and know all these guys have guaranteed money. And he's going to have the choice of coming to training camp and competing against guys who the Pelicans – would have to actually eat a contract to waive or get ready and go to the D League or get ready and go overseas. They're not going to make that choice. So I really believe that the roster we see right now is a roster we'll see in training camp barring trades.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And then, I mean, not to take too much from Summer League, but as of right now, how would you handicap what looks like it's going to be a bit of a battle for the third string center in Withy and Patrick Young? Who did you like and what you've seen, or even skill set wise, what do you think the Pelicans could use more?
So I think that I like Patrick Young because of his motor. I think Patrick Young has the same issue that I saw that he had in college. He's not a rebounder. I don't think he's going to be a rebounder. He just, but he has more energy and he'll cause more havoc than Withy will. I think Withy's a better defender. So, like, here's the thing. Like, people watch these games and they just have come up with this idea because Withy's bricked a lot of shots and he hasn't shown a lot of energy and he hasn't rebounded particularly well. If somebody is driving on towards the rim, Withy is a better protector of that rim than Patrick Young. So if you want a really poor man, Ashik, you take Withy. But I think Patrick Young affects the game in so many other ways. I think his defense is better because he hedges the pick and roll better. So overall, I'd rather have that guy in today's NBA than the guy who's better standing next to the rim. I think he'll try harder and cause more chaos rebounding. He probably won't get his hands on the rebound, but it'll at least make it possible for somebody else to come in and seize it. So I would take Patrick Young over Withy, but I'm not saying that it's like, Patrick Young, if I had 100 votes, I'd give him 99 and Withy 1. It's more like 60-40 in favor of Patrick Young.
And I mean, and how about we have 15 guys signed, only allowed 13 active roster spots. Can you see utilizing the D-League at all? And if so, I mean, who would you be interested in sending there for at least a couple games during the season, if anybody?
I would send both Patrick Young and Russ Smith to the D-League. But Patrick Young, he's a rookie, but he's an old rookie. So I'm not sure how much you're... The thing with Patrick Young is I think he really is what he is. And I don't know if you're going to develop him much more as a basketball player than where he is. Russ Smith, he's also an older guy, but I actually think that with repetition, Russ may be able to cut down on some of the mistakes he's making because he is the ball handler, and the spacing is different than the college game. The way guys move, the way the game works is different than the college game. So, well, for Patrick Patterson, his job doesn't change too much. Maybe he has to take an extra step out on extra step to cover the pick and roll, but basically his job is to bang in the paint and grab rebounds. But Russ Smith, as the lead ball handler, when he's out there, there's a lot of differences that he's going to have to learn. So, sending Russ to the D-League, I think, could help him. I wouldn't say the same thing for Patrick Young. Do you feel differently?
No, yeah, I mean, I'm almost the same exact way as, you know, I think Russ Smith in practices could, you know, it could be valuable for him, but I could see him getting a little antsy sitting on the bench. If the rotation is like what I expect it to be, you know, I could see him getting a lot of inactives and at the very least a lot of DNPs to start the season. I think it would be nice to give him, you know, his own little team to run down in the D League until an injury occurs and you got to bring him up. You know, I would see that as a positive. I don't see anything, again, if everybody goes into a game healthy, you have plenty of ball handlers in our three main guards, Austin and Jim, are now even. We've even seen Terrence Miller play some point guard. So we got six.
And he wasn't bad either.
Yeah, we got six guys who can handle the ball. I don't think even if an injury occurs in a game that we'll wish we had Russ Smith. So, I would say it could be really beneficial to have him down there until you know, an injury occurs. Yeah, I agree with you, Patrick Young, or even somebody like Jeff Withy. You know, we saw that Summer League and D-League aren't exactly the same, but they're a lot alike.
Mm-hmm.
Bigs aren't going to get touches down there. It's not the same game. You know, it doesn't really help develop as much. It's no coincidence that most of the guys who come out of the D-League and succeed are perimeter players. So, I mean, our boy Cole Aldrich looked awesome. It's Summer League. I don't think it's going to translate. I mean, I guess we did this a little before. You still on like a B plus for Dell's off season?
Yeah, I'm not moving off that. I think he improved the team, but I don't think he. So I would say that this team has a good chance to make the playoffs. That's about as far as I would go.
Yeah,
and I every time I look at the league, I wish so bad that conferences were thrown out, because I am 100% willing to state that the Pelicans are a top 12 team in the league next year. But I can't guarantee that means that they're going to be in the playoffs in the Western Conference.
Yeah, although things are shaped. I mean, if this Kevin Love trade goes through, you know, you're basically looking. I mean, it seems like the teams in the West that have a legit shot at the playoffs are dwindling down by the day. I mean, we still don't know how this Phoenix thing is going to play out with Eric Bledsoe, but I mean, Minnesota, the second they make that Love trade for Andrew Wiggins, you know, they're out of the hunt. I always thought Denver was a bit of a dark horse. I mean, you're basically down to 10 teams.
That's still pretty nasty.
Of which
though.
You only have to beat out two. And I know this is stubborn of me. I still think Phoenix was kind of a fluke. And they lost Channing Frye. I think a lot of things went right for them. You know, they added even more youth and just have a weird team. I really think that the Kevin Love trade, it could be a 9-team race. You got to beat out one of those teams. If Anthony Davis is the guy that we think he's going to become, I still don't believe a team with that guy could miss out on the playoffs. But we will see. Got a lot of other good questions on the Twitter feed. We'll save them. A lot of them have to do with, you know, projecting next year, wins, starting lineups, and specific stats and all that stuff. We'll obviously have more podcasts as the season is coming upon us. But, Russ Smith, second team All-NBA for Summer League. Let's just go out on that high note.
Yeah, big assist numbers. He's a monster. So thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. We'll be back a little later in the summer.